don't have a compulsion to be louder, but when there's lots of little people in the house, sometimes it's helpful. I get a kick out of moments in life that feel to me like what I would call a confluence. And as a person who spent lots of years, you know, paddling in whitewater, confluences have a mental image for me, and they're places that where different currents come together, and they can be really powerful, imposing and impressive, and daunting places, but they can also be just spectacular and very moving, no pun intended. There was a time in my life where I think I would have been quicker to point to a God that was kind of deliberately and consciously fiddling with things when moments like that happened than I am now. And I found it interesting to reflect a bit this past week on why that might be for me. One of my friends says that on his relatively short list of questions for God, given the occasion for a face-to-face, high up on that list is the question, just how involved were you? Which I think is an awesome and really compelling question. It's an important thing to consider because how we regard that question has an enormous impact on our mental picture of who God is and what that has to do with everyday life. It's kind of one of those questions that's a bit of a spirituality definer. I don't have anyone in mind in particular in this next bit, so if you feel singled out, it's accidental on my part. But I just want to illustrate a bit of a range around that. Most of us, if we think about this question of just how involved we think God is in everyday events, probably feel like we vacillate just a little about our opinion about that. And we probably also feel like we know people who hold quite a variety of opinions on the matter. If there was a continuum, at one end of the continuum is this sort of this place where God is intimate and causal in almost everything. And I'm having trouble just leaving that, and I'm going to. And at the other end, just confession, I'm confessing. And at the other end is this, there's this, of a continuum, there's a God who's, you know, the watchmaker, the distant caring, yeah, I think there's somebody out there. I can't really imagine all the stars without them. You know, really kind of very distant. And every point in that continuum has its own kind of unique strengths and weaknesses, and some of them are obvious. Some of the challenges anywhere are obvious. If God is intimately involved in the details of everyday life, for instance, how do we account for the why of disasters? And is there really such a thing as an accident? And if God is utterly uninvolved at the other end of the continuum, then why bother wrestling with any of this? Never mind attempting to know God more deeply and all those places in between. And there are lots of places in between. So when I start to ask myself why it is, personally, that I'm less inclined to see God as messing with everyday things than I used to be, it gets into kind of interesting terrain. So I can't help but sometimes feel in those moments where I'm querying myself, I ask myself questions like, am I losing my faith? You know, like, am I losing my faith if I don't care, if I don't think God cares about me finding a parking space when I'm late for a meeting? What about if I'm late for the meeting because I was doing something good? I was doing something pastoral, something religious and good all at the same time, which is like a doubly good thing, as we all know. What about if I'm late for the meeting because of Winnipeg road repairs, which one might argue are morally neutral? What? Even more interestingly, what if I'm late for the meeting because I was doing something bad? See the problem? It's right there in the parking lot. All of that has some bearing on what I think of these confluences that I mentioned at the beginning, of course, because the question is, are those confluences in life things that God is fiddling with or not? And just what I make of those kind of moments in life when a bunch of things feel like they line up with one another in ways that matter deep inside of me, in ways that stir the part of me that senses God or that tilts toward that belief, what do I make of that? And what does all of that have to do with the hang that I mentioned in the blurb? Anyways, confluence first. We'll work our way there. This past week, this confluence that kind of got me thinking about this theme included the biblical story that I was planning to explore this morning, which is the story of Jesus' visit with Mary and her sister Martha, and we're going to read that shortly. A magazine article about why digital detox is the key to happiness. A book called The Happiness Advantage. And an email from Amy, who's leading Kids Table. Those are the things that came together. I'm just going to expand on that as we go. And you can tell me if they seem like a confluence to you or if I was just having one of those God's behind every bush weeks and I just decided they were all. Anyway, here's the story, okay? As they continued their travel, Jesus entered a village. A woman by the name of Martha welcomed him and made him feel quite at home. She had a sister, Mary, who sat before the master, hanging on every word he said. But Martha was pulled away by all she had to do in the kitchen. Later, she stepped in, interrupting them, "Master, don't you care that my sister has abandoned the kitchen to me? Tell her to lend me a hand." The master said, "Martha, dear Martha, you're fussing far too much, getting yourself worked up over nothing. One thing only is essential, and Mary has chosen it. It's the main course, and it won't be taken from her." I'm just going to let that sit there for now. So the magazine article was by a guy named David Roberts, a bit of a rock star political blogger in the U.S. for 10 years with grist.org. And Robert's story in this past year is that he realized he was spending so much time posting and tweeting and staring at screens that he was just starting to lose it. He's in that unique bunch of people in the Twitter sphere who actually reached the daily limit of tweets, which is an enormous number. Anyway, he just realized he was just starting to lose it as a person. And so he pulled the plug on his career for a year. And as he puts it, he wanted to restart his relationship with technology and actively seek health, balance, and adventure in the real world. He was, by his own description, someone who was so immersed in the world of the screen and digital communications that his mind was perpetually in the state that researcher and technology writer Linda Stone calls continuous partial attention. Which Roberts describes as never being completely where he was and never entirely doing what he was doing. So when he announced to his Twitter followers that he was planning to take a year off and regain his physical health and work on a novel, I know, that's what he thought too. He's like, "I'm going to get labeled a weenie," you know. But instead, what happened when he made this announcement was there was just what he calls a torrent of goodwill. And in short order, as he tells the story, there were over 300 responses to that post. Almost everyone positive and supportive, which is an occurrence that he says in the digital realm is the digital internet equivalent of a Sasquatch riding by on a unicorn. It's just not very likely that you're going to get that many responses and they're all going to be supportive and positive, right? Especially when you're a political blogger. His son, his 7-year-old son, Huck, described his job when he asked him one day, "Huck, do you know what I do?" He said, "Yeah, you sit in front of a computer and you go, blah, 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 environment, blah, 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 Mitt Romney, blah, blah, blah." I know, it's funny. Anyhow, the comments were dominated by things like, "I know exactly how you feel, and I'm so glad you're doing this." So that's the magazine article. The book is called The Happiness Advantage by a guy named Sean Acor. This is a guy who spent 10 years at Harvard as a researcher and lecturer, focused on the field of potential and happiness. What do you want to do your doctorate on? I don't know, just make something up. Anyway, there you go. That's what he's researching. And the summary of where he's coming from as a researcher and as a writer of this particular book, and I'm just going to lift this right out of some promotional material for the book, and this is what it said. "Our most commonly held formula for success is broken. Conventional wisdom holds that if we work hard, we will be more successful, and if we are more successful, then we'll be happy. If we can just find that great job, win that next promotion, lose those 5 pounds, happiness will follow. But recent discoveries in the field of positive psychology have shown that this formula is actually backward. Happiness fuels success, not the other way around. When we're positive, our brains are more engaged, creative, motivated, energetic, resilient, and productive at work." You may reasonably guess that this is not the kind of book that I would normally be drawn to. It sort of falls for me into this wider category of positive thinking self-help literature, which often feels kind of like a really bloated and self-absorbed category to me. Not to mention that it's predicated on a fundamentally flawed premise, I think, about what constitutes success. But this one caught my attention because as I kind of stumbled across his research while I was reading something else, the themes that I saw there felt like they had an integral connection to these other things that I was thinking about and experiencing. So there's a bit of a confluence, got my attention. More about those themes that I was thinking about in a bit. And then, this email from Amy. So the email's Amy was in response to the weekly blurb, which a number of you kind of do respond to those blurbs. It's really kind of fun for me, and I enjoy that. So she sent back this response, and what she said was, "That sounds like a neat topic for the morning. It's kind of interesting that I was already planning to do something similar with the kids' table this morning." What she wrote was, quote, "Did you know that the whooping crane, mid-migration, stops to dance. Just a little fun break during 1,000 miles of migration. Actually, that's not exactly what she wrote because her autofill mangled it. I'm not going to read you the other version. I get this subsequent little email saying, just assume I'm a competent writer. That's what she meant to write. So there's the confluence. I want to tell you how those things flowed together, and then you can decide what to do with that. There are, of course, lots of ways to think about what the Mary and Martha story might mean. I was planning to dig into it this morning because in the book of Luke, which is where I've primarily been drawing the parables from that we've been talking about, it follows directly on the story of the beaten-up loser / the Samaritan that we talked about last week. It's kind of this transitional story in the text. And so that was what initially kind of had me going there. It was just the sequence of events. And in that context, it seems pretty likely to me that Jesus isn't suddenly on about something other than what he's been on about through the past several parables. And if I go with that idea, then it seems likely to me that Martha's central challenge in the story is that she's just too busy with her own life to pay what she would see as impractical attention to someone that isn't going to give her the kind of help that she needs. And Jesus, for his part, seems just fine with sitting and being with Mary. And for Martha, who at least in this story is keeping pretty close score of what is fair in life and what isn't, this constitutes an injustice. And so she does what any of us would do if we're kind of thinking like scorekeepers, and she looks for who's to blame for challenging her set of values, and then she just lets them have it. In this particular case, that would be both her sister and Jesus. There is, from Martha's vantage point in this brief story, nothing productive about just hanging around. And if we stay in that space just for a moment, go back to this magazine article. One of the essential discoveries that David Roberts made in his year-long sabbatical was that the core reason we find technology so addicting is something called contingent communication. This is a very intriguing idea to me. This is based on the work of a guy named Dan Siegel, who's a UCLA professor of psychiatry. He's executive director of something called the MindSight Institute. His words: contingent communication happens when a signal sent gets a signal back. Contingent communication happens when a signal sent gets a signal back. Why is that a big deal? Well, that simple act of evoking a response from another mind is a key feature of early childhood development. You talk to any parent, that whole thing when their kid kind of looks at them and recognizes them, we've been sending that signal, you know, from before they were born. I know you, I love you, you're with me, I'm with you. And when it gets sent back, right, the rocket goes off inside of us. We email people, we phone people, we cry, we laugh, we do it again, we try to make them do it again, especially. Everyone wants to see an adult act like a complete idiot. This is the moment, right here. Why? Signal sent, signal comes back. There's this study, a pretty recent one, 2012 out of Boston University, and it was about Facebook use. It found that our Facebook use is driven by two primary needs: the need for self-presentation and the need to belong, which is just another way to say broadcast and be acknowledged. That exchange, broadcast and be acknowledged, that ping back, what happens inside of our brains is that part of us that wonders if we're actually efficacious agents in the world, that wonders if we make any difference here, gets powerfully affirmed just in that send and receive action. In fact, what happens hormonally is that there's this big reinforcing kind of squirt of hormones in the brain's reward center that happens from that send and receive interaction. Really potent stuff. You ever wonder why it's hard to resist looking at your phone if it dings when you're in traffic? Got a 2,000-ton thing, or 2-ton thing you're driving, and this little ping makes you just like put it all on the line? Send, receive. That's what's going on, right there. A little ping back says you matter in the world. It seems that we want to know that quite a lot. But if that becomes a cycle, if that becomes something that has us instead of us having it, in the words of one of my therapist friends,
How do we step out of a cycle like that? Well, there are two general themes that emerge if we look at the work of the folks that want to claim to help us with those kind of challenges. There's kind of these two schools of thought. One in the digital realm, one is a bunch of people that could be grouped together under the broader umbrella of life hackers. And for life hackers, the goal of the different techniques for stepping out of this cycle are really about uber production. They're really about removing distractions so we can be more productive. And that's kind of how the life hacking bundle tends to behave more than not. And there's this whole other front in this, how do we break out of a cycle like that, that tends to emphasize a more spiritual angle. And what often shows up in that kind of batch of remedial responses, if we're stuck in this cycle, is in and around a thing that lots of times gets called mindfulness. I'm not going to go into the history of mindfulness this morning. It has a clear stream to the present. But what I want to touch on about that this morning is just this idea, that to be mindful or attentive to spirit in an age in which our minds are bombarded by things that appear to offer the reward that comes from broadcast and be acknowledged, we have to step away from the bombardment. It sounds stupid and obvious when you say it. At least it does to me. It's like, well, duh. But we do. And that can look like a lot of different things. But there are some themes that kind of rise to the surface if you start poking around in what people are doing. And there are people doing all kinds of interesting stuff. As an adult, I mean, this is a serious issue in lots of our lives. You can go to digital detox camp. You can go to a week-long camp for adults. It'll help you break your habit. One of the prevailing themes about how to deal with the unruly potency of send and receive in the digital realm is that we have to get off the hamster wheel of productivity. We need to step away from what this Sean Aker guy is saying is the broken formula of success, which is the idea that if we work harder, we'll get what we want, and if we get what we want, we'll be happy. One of the things that's broken about that idea is that it constantly moves happiness beyond the horizon. What happens if you get a good grade and that's what was going to make you happy? Well, then you need to get a better grade. What happens if you get a good job and that's what was going to make you happy? Well, then you need a better job. What happens if getting the right relationship is what's going to make you happy? Well, you get in a relationship and it's no longer the right relationship. You got to get a righter one, and then you're going to, see what I'm saying? And so happiness, whatever that means, is always getting moved just over the horizon somewhere in that model. It's never in reach. And in contrast to that, what Acor argues is that there are things we can do that rewire our brains toward what he's calling happiness. Now, even if we have a bone to pick with his definition of success, which I do, he has five what he calls key actions that point people intriguingly in a similar to the direction to the one we're already traveling around, this confluence of ideas. Acor makes a pretty amazing claim about this. He says that if you do these five things for 21 consecutive days, and he's worked with organizations all over the world with this, of course, do these five things for 21 days, you're going to experience the kind of increase in happiness that resets the way you think, because our brains will get reset around this busted idea. Which is a big deal, because in terms of how we feel about life, the way we experience it is only 10% contingent on our circumstance and 90% contingent on what our brain is doing with our circumstance, our perception of our circumstance. Johnny Depp was right. The problem isn't the problem. The problem is your perception of the problem. Whatever the exact quote was. Somebody help me out. Never mind. These are the five things that Acor points out. And they are really interesting. Every day, write down three new things that you're grateful for. They need to be new things each day. Every day, journal about one positive experience you've had in the past 24 hours. That's the second thing. The third thing is exercise, which teaches our brain that our behavioral choices actually matter. Meditate, which he, in this context, says helps us get over the cultural ADHD that's created by trying to do multiple tasks at once and begins to teach our brain to focus on just one thing. And do a daily conscious or random act of kindness. He suggests writing an affirming email first thing when you open your inbox for the day to somebody. Just right out of the chute, first thing you do. One of the reasons I found that list intriguing is because of how many of them look like doing nothing. Have you ever watched somebody journal? I spent a lot of my career working at camp, so I've been to more than my fair share of retreats, arguably. And retreats are often a place where you're kind of like, oh, we're going to get away, and so we're going to reconsider things, and we're going to come at this from a different angle, and people are given time and space to reflect and to journal. So I've had a chance to watch lots of people either journaling or trying to journal. If you've ever had to journal about something, you know that it's actually work. To actually reflect and consider and articulate in some form, that's real effort. But if you watch somebody do it, it doesn't look like they're doing anything most of the time. It looks like they're sitting on the dock, looking out across the lake, or they're laying on the couch, or they're going for a walk in the woods. They're not being productive. You know, they're not making a widget, never mind a better widget or a more profitable widget or a widget that could be made faster by fewer, less trained laborers. Like, they're not working by most of our culture's definitions of work. It looks like they're doing nothing. By the way, going for a walk in a non-urban setting changes our brain speed in amounts that are super easy to measure. Like, it really changes our brain speed as opposed to going for a walk in an urban environment. That's interesting in itself. We're not going to explore it. But I find that intriguing. Because when our brain slows down, what goes up? Creativity goes up. Our clarity goes up. Our capacity for social engagement goes up. A lot of those things have a fair bit to do with the thing that Achor is calling happiness, don't they? Which brings us, in my imagination, to Amy's illustration of the migrating cranes that stop mid-journey to dance a little. Which brings us right back to Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus while her version of hyperactivity swirls around her. And it feels to me as though we have an ancient future kind of moment here. Like everything old is new again, you know? Mary seems to know something. I don't think it's an unfair read of the story, that Mary seems to know something that we could all stand to learn, which is that if we want our world to be more full of the things that enliven us as whole persons, which I think happiness is an attempt to articulate, and I would say that those things, that essential to those things being enlivened is that what I would call spirit becomes stirred more deeply. We become more attenuated to the things in our life that will not be managed by any technology, anywhere, anytime. And this is not an anti-technology rant. But if we want those things to be stirred in us, if we want the goodness that flows from our interior world to our exterior world to get stirred, then we have to choose for that to happen. It's interesting to me how much kind of what I would call mythology a lot of Western Christianity seems to have built up around the benefits package that's supposed to come with becoming a Christian. Which is like, and once again, we don't have time to explore the history of that little turn of phrase, do we? But boy, could we. Anyway, I'm just going to say this about that turn of phrase. It reeks of the way of Jesus being something you switch on, and then it's on. Book. The Mary and Martha story would suggest something really different. When I said earlier that from Martha's vantage point there was nothing productive about just hanging around, I think we were poking at that thing. Martha, like many of us, have been taught to think about what it means to be a Christian. Martha is so busy with her
own life and regards just hanging for spiritual purposes as impractical, because from her vantage point, the presence of Jesus in the story means she should be getting helped with whatever it is that is weighing her down. And that's what it means that Jesus is in the story. When Jesus shows up, you get the kind of help that you want. That's the benefits package that comes when you flip the on switch with being a Christian, right? Right? How's that working out? I'm not being cynical here. I'm just saying I think we've seriously lost our way around this as a culture. And so we've got this kind of religious mythology around the way of Jesus that basically adds up to something like religious behaviors well kept equals blessing. Blessing equals getting what I want. It's the exact same blueprint as when I get what I want, I'll be happy. It's the same myth. And it's just as busted. It's just as backward. It would seem, though, that as Jesus sees it, and as Mary seems to as well, that blueprint is actually not a good pathway to what the paraphrase I read of the story calls essential. It's not essential. It's actually a broken pathway that points us to our hunger for what's essential. And what's essential is already present in the environment we're in. What's essential is not over the horizon. From the vantage point of the Christian story of the actions of God in the world, the essential thing that has to do with our happiness as whole orb people, people of body, mind, and spirit, is something that God has always had in hand, and that the story of Christ illustrates powerfully. God is capable of acting in the world. Our gig is not to cause God to give us what we want, so we'll be happy. Broken formula. Our gig is to pay attention. Our gig is to train our body, our mind, and our spirit. And right now in the 21st century, our best word for mind is brain, and most of what I've been talking about this morning comes from brain science. Is to train our whole self to pay attention to that truth. That the things that we need to be the people we were made to be are already present in the world. I'm not gonna try to disassemble Acor's conviction that if I just get the new formula right, I'll be happy, and if I'm happy, I'll be more productive, and if I'm productive, I'll be rich. I'm just not going to take that on. I'm going to say I think that's a different kind of broken, and just leave it there. Because I actually don't think the things that he's naming success are the things that come as attendant to what I would think of as happiness. Otherwise, there's an awful lot of the world that doesn't have the most remote shot at a full life. And to me, that feels like an untenable thing. Whether I'm correct about that or not, that's a thing to wrestle with. But that's my gut on it. So our job, you know, is to do what we need to do with the everydayness of our life so that we continue to face toward the only thing that is essential, toward essence. We're not going to all define that the same all the time, by the way. But one of the things I love is when life brings those kind of confluences, when I can look around my week and go, I've got a biblical narrative, this is from a text that I believe is inspired and inspiring both. I've got an email from a friend and a colleague. I got a magazine article on digital detox, which is not an article that I read because I feel a compelling drive to take a year off so I can stop using my phone, but inside of there was all of these things that felt like they belonged together. And the research of some Harvard guy who
has a new formula for success, whose fundamental idea I find fatally flawed, but whose methodology feels like it's deeply akin to the wisdom of the ages about how to open my brain to spirit. Which I think I need. Which I think we all need. I don't think God needs to fiddle with the details for that to happen, because I think God made a world in which things that are true will be congruent. If I'm paying attention, I just might notice. And that might help me face my whole self toward the one thing that is essential. And that's good. And that's right. And it's true. And it's lovely. Peace.